Today I have the good fortune and honor to welcome and tell you about someone who probably needs no introduction to this community, Dr. Peter McCormick. Born in Edmonton, grew up in Lacombe, educated at the University of Alberta, the University of Toronto, and the London School of Economics. He returned to Canada, taught initially at Lakehead University for 2 years, and the University of British Columbia for one, before coming to Lethbridge. Interestingly, he came here in 1975, when the University of Lethbridge, at least for some of us who grew up here, would think it was in its infancy. He had the good fortune to marry a Lethbridge girl, and he and his wife have two children, Scott, now aged 35, who's married, and who is teaching high school at a private school in Washington, D.C., and his daughter, Lisa, who's now finishing her Ph.D. in sociology at Yale. Dr. McCormick's research these days is mostly to do with constitutional law and appeal court decision-making. Someone like myself finds it very interesting and stimulating. In addition, he's written 5 books about 60 journal articles on these subjects. His hobby, as most of you are aware of, is Canadian and provincial politics, which have never been more interesting. He has just finished serving as the president of the University of Lethbridge Faculty Association and is now serving as the president of the Confederation of Alberta Faculty Associations. He's also a member of the SSHRSC, the Standard Research Grant Committee, and he's also involved in 2 political and public policy website projects, Maple Leaf Web and policy.ca. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our distinguished presenter and have you give a warm welcome to Dr. Peter McCormick.
Well, whatever else you might want to say about Canadian politics and Alberta politics these days, at least it isn't dull. We have a new Liberal leader in Ottawa as the Harper government enters its second year, and we have a new premier in Edmonton as we all adjust to life after Ralph. The times, they are indeed a-changing. Well, let's start with Ottawa. Actually, to be honest, we're just going to do Ottawa. When Gordon called me, there wasn't a whole lot going on, and I said, I'm going to need both of them to fill the time. By the time I get here, of course, they've been having so much fun in Ottawa that that's all we're going to do. I'll take you right up to my segue to Alberta, but then just as you're panicking, I will stop. Okay, let's start with Ottawa. From the point of view of the Conservative government, their first year in office didn't go as well as they hoped, but it could have gone a whole lot worse. On the positive side, the first point to make is that the party and the cabinet are holding together surprisingly well, considering how recent the surgery was that created the new United Right. I really would have expected to see some fault lines opening up, or at the very least, some of their backbenchers giving us moments of hilarity on the national news. But so far, they staved off both of those problems. I was really surprised when Vic Taves was demoted from Minister of Justice to a lesser cabinet position, and I didn't hear a squeak of complaint from anywhere, not from Vic, not from people in caucus, not from any of his constituents out west. Now that's the sign of a party really holding together, and I'm quite surprised they've done as well at that. Now, I know a lot of people complain that Stephen is keeping the lid on so tight it isn't even fair, democratic, or anything else, but from the point of view of the party, it's a good thing. This used to be a party that leaked like a sieve and split when you said hello to it, and instead they're holding things together remarkably well. Secondly, by and large, the cabinet has come up to the mark, to the extent that there is a cabinet beyond Stephen Harper and a few friends meeting in his office, but to the extent we have a cabinet, it's come up to the mark. There haven't been any disasters. A couple of misfortunes, but no outright disasters, no scandals whatever. It's held together pretty well. It's held together so much so that the cabinet shuffle, Harper had the luxury of a cabinet shuffle that was directed toward repositioning his government and making it a bit stronger, not trying to stave off disaster or fix some colossal mistake that was really costing them big time. In the shuffle, I was absolutely astonished by one shuffle, and since I forgot to mention this during the week when it happened, I had a chance to. I am astonished that John Nicholson was moved from House Leader to Justice. I was surprised that Taves was moved down, but once the vacancy was there, I was astonished to see Nicholson go up, because Nicholson was the House Leader. Now, House Leader is one of those positions that doesn't sound like a big deal from the outside, but especially in a minority government. and even in a majority government to some extent, this is the most important person on the government side. This is the person who makes the deals, right? Who's always wheeling and dealing with the opposition, always lining up the votes, always sensing danger just before it shows up. To paraphrase what the British used to say about the commander of the British home fleet in World War I, this is the only person who could lose the war in a single afternoon. And that's what the government house leader is over and over again. When you've got a good one, and everything I heard from Ottawa said Nicholson was good. I mean, not the best ever, but a cut above average. He was doing a great job as house leader in an impossible situation, and yet you move him. What a statement of confidence in the people that Harper thinks he's finding on his backbenches, and especially Peter Van Loan, the guy he's moved into the House Leader position. That was the most important part of the shuffle, and we missed it all in the excitement over the environment. But from Harper's point of view, that's got to be a strong statement about his cabinet and the strength that he sees around it. Thirdly, the Conservatives are getting a very modest legislative agenda through. They set themselves a modest task when they were first elected. They're working their way down the list. This is important because once the election is called, voters don't want excuses, they want to see what you've done. And he's starting to get some check marks on that page in the places where he wanted them. It even looks like his Clean Air Act is going to go through in the next week or two or three in some recognizable form, so that's another success for them. And fourthly, and most important, as Harper looks back on the last year, there's the fact that Jean Charest no longer seems to be in hopeless trouble in the province of Quebec. A year ago, we'd written Charest off. It's just a question of when he decides to commit suicide by calling the election. As soon as he calls it, he's gone. He's on the trash heap of history. Well, Harper needs Charest in Quebec. The only way the Conservatives can ever hope to build on their bridgehead in Quebec is to have someone with Jean Charest's credibility in a position of some authority in the province to help them out any way he can. Now, I don't think they can build even with that, but that's a different question. Without Charest, they're not even in the game. They can't hope to be. And a year ago, we thought Charest and his Liberals were finished for the next provincial election. The polls now, it's not so much he's done well. His opponent has done badly. But in politics, that's the same thing. It's just you do better than the other guy. It doesn't matter who's going up and who's going down as long as you're ahead. So Charest is now looking quite strong. Don't break out the bubbly just yet, but going into the election, which will probably be in April, it looks like the Liberals are in good shape and the PQ is fading, so Charest may very well be there for the next 4 or 5 years, and for Harper, that is extremely good news. Now, on the bad side, and there is a bad side, the worst bad side is the Conservatives didn't manage to maintain any momentum whatever in public opinion after the election in 2006. One would have thought that coming into office, finally making it over that hump, and the Liberals finally not being the government, which happens so rarely, few of us know what to do with it, you would have thought that that would have created a momentum that would have carried on for a while. And nope, no momentum whatever. If anything, the Conservatives peaked during the election campaign and have been lucky to hold steady for a while and are now sagging a bit. Meanwhile, the Liberals, after running the worst campaign in living memory, and came through the election in surprisingly good order and are now recovering. So if you're a Conservative, it's sort of, what do you have to do to beat these guys? You keep, you thump them 14 times and they shake it off and keep coming. It's very frustrating. There seems to be a real brand resistance the Conservatives are running into, and they just can't break through it. What this suggests is the Liberals are now down to bedrock support. It's the lowest in living memory. That's bad news for the Liberals. It can't go much lower. That's the good news. The second piece of bad news is the Tories totally botched the environment portfolio. I mean, just totally. Possible score of 100, actual score is 0. Actually, maybe they didn't do quite that well. It's hard to see how they could have played it worse. They campaigned against the whole notion of climate change in general and Kyoto in particular. They equivocated for as long as they could. Then they came out with this utterly transparent ploy of let's not talk global warming, that's fuzzy stuff. Let's talk pollution. Let's talk about you coughing and your eyes hurting when you go out to drive your car to work. We'll go after pollution. Clean air is the real problem. Well, everyone saw that when coming 2 miles back, and everyone was ready for it, and no one was fooled by it. And as a result, of course, they lost Rona Ambrose, who threw herself on the sword for the good of the party, which is the price you pay for being minister sometimes. Not that anybody ever thought it was her idea in the first place, of course not. But ministers take the blame for things like this. And now I think for the conservatives, this is terrible news because their timing couldn't have been worse. This is the year that Canadians are starting to turn away from worrying about health care, having now realized no one's ever going to fix it. What you see is what you get. And are now moving on to discover this new problem called global warming. Until yesterday, I could have said, today is taking away my line, but this, in many ways, is the year without winter. This is the year we forgot to have a winter. This is the year when even the skeptics say something's happening out there. So public attention is starting to swing over to the global warming issue, just as the conservatives go 0 for 100 on the, for a score in that particular portfolio. And that's why the cabinet shuffle. That's how you redeploy yourself and come up with a bold new position. You dump the old cabinet minister, bring in a new one. Of course, it's all smoke and mirrors, but that's how politics is played. And I think this is make or break for the conservatives. I think if they can't get some kind of a handle on the environmental issue, get some kind of credibility, at least belong on the stage, then they're in incredible trouble. And this is their big test. And that's why someone as important to Harper as Baird was shifted to the environment portfolio. He's one of the best Harper's got. Therefore, you give him the ball in the critical place. Now, in some ways, it looks like we're approaching a really critical moment in federal politics, right? That, we've had the year while the Liberals regrouped. Harper's had his year to settle into office. Now we get on to the real fight. One reason for suggesting this, of course, is the Liberals have got a new leader, and not just that, they had the perfect leadership race. I mean, if you plan these things out, what you don't want is a dull leadership race. What if you gave a race and nobody came, right? Those aren't any good. What if you had a race and two sides get so mad at each other they won't talk to each other anymore? That's bad. But what you want is an entertaining race, an exciting race, a race that has got a front runner, it's got a challenger, it's got dark horse candidates, it's got variety among the candidates, some issues come up, they divide the party, but not so badly you can't get together afterward and smile. And it was a perfect leadership race. Then it's won in, you work into the ballot and the dark horse candidate comes through in a come from behind win. And then the ultimate bonus, he's the most experienced guy in the room, but he counts as a rookie. How on earth, if you'd set it up, how could you have done it better, So for the Liberals, this is about as good as it gets. Not only that, he's organized his whole campaign as leader around the issue which is now emerging as the most important in the country, and the Conservatives have flubbed it. I mean, you're scoring 150 out of 100 at that point. You better stop, because you just can't do it any better than that. Okay, the second reason why we seem to be approaching a climax is we're approaching budget season. And budget season is the time when oppositions go hunting governments, because the budget is when you have to put a whole lot of things out on the table at one time. It gives the opposition a lot of things not to like, and if you're really lucky, it gives you a lot of things not to like together, which is when governments come down. And as regards the convention in this country about non-confidence and defeating governments, there's way more flex in that than most people realize. There's no flex on budget votes. If you lose the budget vote, you go down and you stay down. So it's a really tempting target, and there's no place for the government to wiggle on it. Joe Clark's minority government was defeated over the budget. Well, technically not quite, but I won't give you that one because nobody cares. Okay, basically, Clark's government went down over a budget vote. Now, does this mean we're now counting down for a spring election? I would say absolutely not. I don't think anybody wants an election. I mean, nobody does. In a minority government, of course, all the opposition parties have to be champing for an election tomorrow morning, if not earlier, because that's just the dynamics of minority. And they've got to keep the suspense and the pressure up all the time. But I think the truth is that nobody wants an election right now. So I will fearlessly predict, this usually goes wrong for me, but I'll try it anyway. I will fearlessly predict no election this spring, probably no election in this calendar year. We'll get another year of this before anybody pulls the plug on it. And the reason, like I say, nobody wants it. The Bloc would have to be crazy to force an election. If you're the Bloc, what do you want a Canadian election to give you? Number one, you want a weak national government, preferably a conservative government. Number two, you want a big, massive lump of the seats from the province of Quebec so that you can stand up for Quebec every time people twitch. Well, you've got it. So So what, you're going to defeat this government and try for something better? There is nothing better. You've got everything. Now, it's true that the election wasn't as much fun as you thought it was going to be. And you lost votes and seats to the Conservatives. Oh, the humiliation of it. You know? So that part wasn't fun. But you still wound up exactly where you wanted to be. Weakest government in Canadian history. Needing permission from the opposition parties to go to the washroom. It's the weakest government we've ever had in the history of the country. You're dominating Quebec. There's nobody in sight. You've humiliated the Liberals in Quebec. Hey, this is it. This is as good as it gets. So you'll make noises all day long because that's part of the fun. You know? If a minister doesn't tremble, you haven't had a good day. But you don't actually want to defeat the government because you can't improve where you are right now. The New Democrats certainly don't want an election right now. The NDs are you got to feel sorry for them, right? I mean, this is the century where the issues are all going their way and it doesn't do them any good, you know? They go through an election campaign and they count it as victory if they didn't lose too many voters during the campaign who want to go off and vote strategically, which means against Tories. So you know, you're trying to hang on to your vote, not gain more, just hang on to it. And now that the election is over, along comes the Green Party getting all kinds of play. And at the moment, the NDs' great fear is they'll get caught between the Greens on one side, the Liberals on the other, and down that path lies nothing but a world of hurt for the New Democrats. So do you want an election campaign right now? Heck no. Minor parties like the Green Party have a heck of a time keeping press attention. You want to allow time for the media to forget about Elizabeth May. That's what you're waiting for. Just let them forget about the Green Party, let them fade out of people's consciousness, and then the NDs have got a better chance. Also, you want things to go your way in the House of Commons, but I'll get there in a second. Actually, the Liberals don't want an election right now either. I just finished setting it up, so you must be thinking they're drooling in their chops at the thought of an election. They've had a wonderful leadership race. They're doing okay in the polls. The Conservatives seem stuck, and the issue is cutting their way. It must be time for an election. Well, no, for two reasons. The first one is the Liberals came through the country in English Canada pretty well in the last election, better than they must have thought for most of the campaign. You know, whew, dodged a bullet on that one. But in the province of Quebec, it really couldn't have got much worse. They just got clobbered. They got murdered. They got demolished. They got reduced to the English end of the island of Montreal. You know, way to go. Now, that's the Liberal Party of Quebec right now. You can walk from one ride. All the Liberal ridings are a block in the west end of Montreal. You can go on a walking tour in a single afternoon and cover all of Liberal Quebec. And, you know, none of it missing. It's all right there, compactly in one place. It's just horrible. And they placed third in popular vote. Third behind the... Okay, they're in real trouble in Quebec. They've been destroyed. They have to rebuild. They've only had 1 year. It's not long enough. So they need to rebuild in Quebec. Second thing is they need to get some money. They've got no money. They're really short of cash. They could not run a really good national campaign right now if you call the election tomorrow. They just don't have the money. And the reason they don't have the money is because Jean Chrétien wanted to stick it to Paul Martin as he was slipping out of office. So he brought in this new campaign legislation, which disadvantaged everything the Liberals were good at in terms of getting money and privileged everything the Conservatives were getting really good at in terms of getting money. So the net result is exactly what you'd think. The Conservatives have enough money they can put this ad campaign on. You know, you think about how much that's costing. They can throw that away without an election in the prospect because they've got money. The Liberals don't have money. So you're a bit reluctant to call an election when the mismatch is that great. But finally, the Conservatives definitely don't want an election right now. And the main reason they don't is they might lose. And being government is more fun than being opposition. They're discovering that. So, you know, if you are government and that was the point, then why would you call the election? Unless you sense a majority. Oh, don't be silly. There are no majorities in Canada for the next decade. Not going to happen. So you've got no incentive to call the election whatever. They're behind in the polls. They're offside in the biggest public issue going. I mean, they probably won't be the government if they call an election right away. They'll be the opposition again. So what's the point? It's got to be frustrating for them. I mean, they've worked hard in government. They swallowed their pride. They've done all kinds of things in office that they would have condemned in stereo if they were still in opposition. They've kept the Mavericks in line. They've kowtowed to ideas they once ridiculed. And they still can't get any respect from the public. They still can't move an inch in the polls. It's really, okay, if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny. And most importantly, most Canadians don't want an election right now. Canadians have finally worked out that minority governments are actually a pretty good deal, because minority governments care what you think. Boy, do they care. You know, everybody cares what you think every minute of the day. And if you're worried about a government having a hidden agenda, why worry? They can't do a darn thing about it anyway. You know, so that's completely contained. And nor do we have any reason to think that another election would give us anything other than another minority government. So why bother? We've already got one. So why go through all that mess and kerfuffle and noise for that? So for the short term, what you see is what you get. We've got an incredibly cautious and controlled conservative government. It's in power but nervous. And the three opposition parties keep jockeying for a bit of influence over exactly what a piece of legislation looks like. And everything stays in doubt till the last minute. But okay, in the end, it sort of kind of works. And that's what we get. Now that's the short term. How about the medium term? Or to put it a bit differently, what gives with the attack ads? How many of you have seen the attack ads? There are three, you know. I'm not sure you've seen all three, but there are three of them out. Okay, the conservatives have come out with attack ads going after Stéphane Dion. Now, I say there's three. If you haven't seen them, you can go, for some of you this will be hard to try, you can do it really. Go to the Conservative Party website, and they've got the they've got the three ads up there so that you can look at them. That is part of the point, is TV is the teaser, but the website's where they really want you to go. As far as attack ads go, they're pretty mild stuff. I mean, you know, compared with what the Liberals were pouring out in the last election, this is you know, mini attack or attack light or something. But it is costing them real money. There's got to be a real calculation going on there. And your first reaction would be that the heck with what McCormick just said, the Tories want an election. They're all set to provoke it or call it at the earliest opportunity. And they're just getting an early start. But I've already told you why that isn't the case. So I think there's three reasons why they're doing this. The first reason why they're doing it is with no evidence whatever, and therefore I could be completely wrong, but I'll say it anyway. I am convinced that the conservative polling is showing that Canadians don't yet know quite what to make of Dion. Now this is bizarre, because Dion has been a major player in the National Liberal Party for a decade. I mean, Chrétien recruited him in 1996. He's been in the cabinet, in the Liberal cabinet, with a short interruption until he went down. And when Paul Martin dumped him from cabinet, which is what you'd expect Paul Martin to do to a Chrétien protege, Paul Martin undumped him within a matter of months. I mean, this is a guy who matters inside the Liberal Party and inside the Liberal Party in the province of Quebec. And yet he's managed to do that for 10 years without ever getting the profile or the publicity or the clear image in the public eye that some of his colleagues did. So I think Dion is a bit of an unknown quantity, and Canadians are still trying to decide what to, you know, what to think about this guy. And I think the Conservatives are generously offering to help, you know, just making sure you don't accidentally form too positive an attitude toward this guy. They're going to feed in some second thoughts for you. So the Tories, there are three ads. The one just says, don't let the Liberals back in, which is a real helpful comment. But the second one says that Dion is not a real leader, which also strikes me as rather a strange one. And the third one, which I think is really the heart of the campaign, is that Dion did not get the job done as Liberal Environment Minister. And you're already starting to see that in the House of Commons. Expect to get really tired of that phrase over the next few months, okay? Dion did not get the job done. Count how many times you hear that from conservatives over the next 3 months, and you're going to be up in the hundreds, I'm sure, because this is the game plan, is planting thoughts along that line in the minds of Canadian voters as they think about the new Liberal leader. Now, the second thing that's reflected by the ad is something which is in the polling, and I have seen the figures, so I'm not guessing on this one. This one you can count on. Most of us, when we hear about a poll, we flip through to find what the relative party strengths are, right? You know, voting intention if a vote were being held today. Okay, you want to flip through a few more pages. Find the one where Canadians are being asked who they think would make the best prime minister. Which of the party leaders would make the best prime minister? The numbers there make the Liberals unhappy and the Conservatives happy. Harper is way out ahead, and there's no signs that it's weakening. So we have this weird situation that Canadians are resistant to the Conservative brand of politics, but they're starting to feel comfortable with Stephen Harper being in the Prime Minister's chair, at least in a minority position. And on that particular count, nobody's really challenging too hard. So in a, the liberal weakness, which is no one's quite sure what to make of Dion just yet, meshes nicely with the conservative strength, which is we're not sure about conservatives, but that Harper guy's okay. And you can see the beginning of the conservative campaign strategy. You can see that Dion did not get the job done, but Stephen Harper is getting the job done. So don't think of it as voting conservative. We know you're having trouble with that. Think of it as voting Harper. And you know, as strategies go, that's not a bad one. That does give them some opportunity. And I think we're seeing the beginning of that in this ad strategy. Like I say, it's that third one that I attach the importance to. And that takes me to the third thing. I've already said so often you're tired of it, but you get it one more time anyway. The Tories' great failure so far has been the environmental issue. They have just utterly bombed on that one. Dion's great theme has been the environment. The emerging public issue of choice is the environment. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to know what they're talking about when the prime minister sits down with his strategist. They're talking about the environment. Crudely, they have a year, maybe less, to buy themselves a corner of the environmental issue to gain some credibility. And the more so because Dion has nailed his flag to the environmental mast, the more traction the Tories can get on that issue.